Let me say that this is not your typical lecture. We're not going to be talking about hypotheses, data analysis, and conclusions. And it really amounts to a discussion of the sociology of science. And actually, I find that pretty fascinating, and I don't think we talk about that much. You may pick it up in memoirs of people like Barbara McClintock or other notables, but the sociology of science is quite fascinating, and I'll give you a little bit of my experience in this whole business. So anyway, I might start by saying that 42 years ago, I graduated with a master's degree from the University of Michigan, and I was on my way to the University of Minnesota to do my PhD with Herb Coleman. And the U.S. Forest Service developed an opening for someone working on seed and cone insects. And fortunately, they hired me, and they agreed that when I began, I could finish or do my PhD there while I was working on the seed and cone insect problem. And so I began at the University of Minnesota, working both for the U.S. Forest Service and enrolled in a PhD program at the entomology department. I almost need my glasses to see these buttons. Any button will do me, or I gotta do a down button here.
Where the mouse?
Okay, I got it. So, when you think about it, you know, can you really predict where your career is going to go and what your problems are going to be in academia or research? And as I look back on my career, everything was so unpredictable in retrospect that I'm just dumbfounded by it. And of course, we're all basically works in progress, and that's the way I've thought of myself. And what bothers me today is that after 42 years, you know, I'm still a pretty big work in progress. And have I learned anything? And I guess I have, but there's just so many areas of new knowledge that are missing in my background that I still feel very awed by the need to know a great deal more in order to understand the complex problems we deal with. But we're all products of our environment, and as I and you reflect on where you've been and what you're doing, it comes home clear to me that environment has had a huge impact. The people I've worked with, the environments I've learned in, have had a huge impact of how I thought and the kinds of problems I ended up working on. And I might just say that this role of serendipity in my career has repeated itself again and again and again, and I'll tell you a little bit about that. So where did I come from, and what are these environments? What was the context in which I was educated and worked? Well, I started at the School of Natural Resources at the University of Michigan, and I was in the school there for four great years. It was an incredible environment in which to learn and grow. And let's see if I can find here it is. If I can get the pointer to work here. I think I got it, Dan. This is kind of a dim one, isn't it?
Okay.
No, not that.
This one right here?
Yeah, try that.
Uh-oh. Did something wrong here. Oh, I better not touch that one. But anyway, let me say that I was blessed to have taken two classes from a man by the name of Sam Graham, who I call the Sage, because his lectures were always interspersed with these just wise aphorisms. And I always remember this one. He said, "Never become so busy that you don't have time to sit on a stump and think." And he was an inspiring person. He had already retired, but he was an incredible teacher. And there were others as well. Well, I left Michigan went to the University of Minnesota, and I enrolled in the Department of Entomology to do my PhD, and that also was an incredible environment. And just as I was finishing, the entomology department changed into the Department of Entomology, Fisheries, and Wildlife. And that was actually an even richer environment, because now I got to hear lectures by fisheries biologists, wildlife biologists, entomologists, and they were all, to me, they all seemed like they had a great story to tell about how the world was put together. At the same time, as I mentioned, I was working for the North Central Forest Experiment Station, and I spent from 67 to 82 there. And I have this picture here because that was just a hothouse of intellectual fermentation. There were lots of young people as well as really intellectually stimulating older scientists working there, and there was always arguments at the coffee tables and in the hallways about one thing or another. And I just was stunned by the excitement that went on there. And this picture happens to be a class that was taught. The station sponsored the man you see in the bottom right. His name is Mario Bunga. They sponsored him to come and spend 2 weeks teaching whoever wished to learn about the philosophy of science. Well, Mario Bunga is one of the most published authors in philosophy of science. He's still working at McGill University today in his 90s, and he has published over 80 books on the philosophy of science. But he taught a class that was really outstanding, and I remember after having taken that class, I began to think about how I think about plants, animals, in a completely different way. In fact, he has a fingerprint on the way I've thought and described my subjects for research. But next to him was a mathematician who came on the same time as I did, Rolf Leary. And he was actually the spark plug who started this kind of vigorous discussion about philosophy of science, scientific methods, how you select problems. And he has published a book actually about interactions. So these two in the lower right hand corner had a fingerprint on just about everything I did for the next 10 years and even following that. You can see up in the upper left-hand corner, there's young grasshopper with dark hair, and his first boss, William Miller, you may see that. Miller was an extraordinary supervisor and intellectually demanding. I shuddered when I passed him one of my manuscripts because he was the editor for Forest Science at the time, and he was just tough as nails. And so Bill always put my manuscripts through the grill, I'll tell you. Next one. So my first job, what did I do? I was hired to study seeded cone insect issues in red pine seed production areas in the Great Lakes area. Why? Because they weren't getting any seed out of these orchards. So they said, something's wrong, we think it's insects, this was the National Forest, asked us to start on this. So I spent the next 5 years working on this problem, trying to figure out what are the major sources of mortality in red pine seed production areas. Lo and behold, I was finishing my thesis, it looked like we had an excellent story to tell. In fact, this is the primary paper that came out of that. And whoops, I was feeling elated that we had really solved what all the issues were. We knew what the problems were. And they said, you know what? We're really not interested in red pine anymore because we've discovered there's so little genetic variation in red pine that we don't need seed production areas. We can collect seed any place. And so I felt so deflated. I thought it was a lesson learned. I said, I don't know if I should ever let anybody tell me what my scientific problems are going to be. I think I need to think about them myself. And actually, what this did was it fell into another crisis at this time. There were two insect projects. We had a major budget crisis, and we could no longer support two projects. So we had to combine projects, let some temporaries go, and we decided we're going to pick our own problems. We won't allow with anyone else to decide what are the major problems that we should address. And so we developed this this guide over here on the left. And we use that guide to select the problem that our combined force would work on. And it turned out that we rated a whole slug of insects, and the insect that came out on the top of this was the Force 10 caterpillar. Well, it just so happened that John Witter was finishing his PhD just about the time that we were moving all of our forces to work on the Force 10 caterpillar. And so John was at the University of Minnesota, and so John and I teamed together to write up his one of his major papers was this numerical analysis of a 10 caterpillar outbreak. Unfortunately, this outbreak was continuing, so we decided we were going to study the impact of the Force 10 caterpillar on ecosystem structure function, primarily looking at primary production and nutrient cycling. And so we began a big project on this, and we launched into about 4 years of sampling all over northern Minnesota and northern Michigan, looking at life table studies of Force 10 caterpillar. It was a huge study. And as we tromped through the forest looking for 10 caterpillars to sample, I began to be fascinated by the things that we weren't doing. These insects had these strange behavior patterns, and we were taking down trees. And I thought to myself, you know, we're missing something here. We're just counting insects, but we're missing something. And I began to believe that the host plant quality had a lot to do with where they laid their eggs, how many survived on an individual tree, how many didn't. And so it piqued my interest then in the role of the plant in determining the success of the insect, because up until that point, I had just thought, it's just green fodder. Well, from that study, this big Force 10 caterpillar study, I began to think about insects as members of forest ecosystems. And these two people, Professor Bacuzis and Ralph Leary, were instrumental in my development of this paper. I took a class from Professor Bacuzis. I call him the master, because you can see his library. This is the way my library looks, by the way. I copied his. He was an unbelievable collector and reader of literature, and he always talked about blizzards of papers coming out and nothing new. And so he said, you know, I want you all to read more and to write less. And he said, what about Klomp from the Netherlands? He spent 10 years working on his PhD. That's what you should do. You know, study the problem, understand the problem. And Bacuzis became a mentor, and he just died 2 years ago, and he practically died in his office. He spent his entire career chasing the ultimate laws that would allow him to understand how ecosystems function. And although he never achieved that end, he never doubted at any time that he wouldn't eventually arrive there, and I admired him. Along the same time I was working on the Force 10 caterpillar, I began to wonder, you know, what is it about these trees that these insects seem to avoid or be attracted to? And I became interested in this whole question. And so a friend was working at Kansas State University, and he said, why don't you come over here and give us a lecture on that stuff you're talking about? And so I went down to Kansas State and had a lecture about that title almost. And after the lecture, a guy came up to me and said, I'm Charles Michener. He said, I'm on the editorial board for Annual Reviews of Ecology and Systematics. Would you be interested in writing up that seminar for an annual review paper? I was floored. And so I spent the next 6 months actually putting this paper together. And so it was another one of those cases of serendipity. I really didn't have a very well-developed lecture, I thought, and I was a little bit intimidated about going there and just talking from the top of my head. But it got Michener's attention. And so that's actually the origin of that paper. And I began to think deeply about, you know, how it is we perceive plants, how do insects perceive plants. And following Bunga had published a book called Ontology, Furniture of the World. And in that book, he talks about the traits and properties of objects and entities. And so I began to think about that, and there was a UFRO symposium that was occurring in the Netherlands on the subject of resistance to diseases and pests and forest trees. And so I thought, I'm going to go to that UFRO symposium and give this paper. And anyway, so I gave this paper, and in it I talked about phenological ontogenetic windows. And so for the next 5 to 10 years, we tried to define phenological windows in plants. And Rob Lawrence, one of my doctoral students, did a really nice job describing and identifying the phenological window and the traits that are plant traits that are responsible for the closing of that window with respect to the spruce budworm. Another serendipity. At the same time I was working on the spruce budworm, because we had just received some grant money for spruce budworm, and I had hypothesized that drought stress was somehow triggering outbreaks, and I wasn't sure exactly what the mechanism was. And so we had started some work, and it was incredibly difficult to do. But I got a letter from Professor Barbosa and Schultz asking if I would be interested in writing a paper on drought stress on outbreaks of plant-eating insects. And so one of my postdocs, Bob Hack, and I put together a manuscript for the book chapter, and we had worked so hard and we couldn't put everything we wanted to the book chapter, so then we decided we were going to write a separate paper putting all of the things that we didn't get published into the book chapter, into this paper that eventually went into Bioscience. And so again, it was, if we hadn't received that invitation to write that book chapter, of course I didn't think I knew enough to write a book chapter, but I said, well, let's start and we'll see what happens. And again, this is another interesting story. I went to, 1983, I went to a UFRO meeting, an International Union of Forest Research Insect meeting in Banff. And Alan Berryman was at this meeting, and he got up and said, I want to propose that we develop a new working party on plant-insect interactions. And I thought, wow, what a great idea. And shortly after some discussion about this, Tom Payne got up and said, I nominate Bill Mattson to lead this new working party. And I was floored. And of course, the election pursued, and nobody else wanted to lead this thing. So I became the default leader. And it turned out that that was an incredibly broadening and stimulating piece of involvement for me. And we produced several of these symposia, and I was fortunate enough to work with lots of great people. And I remember going to one of these UFRO meetings in the USSR with Tom Payne and others, and Tom and Werner were discussing what they needed to have a successful meeting, and I see Tom got right to the point. How much vodka do we need? And of course, then I was lucky enough to travel with Peter in Finland a couple of years ago, and we were on a train going from Turku to Helsinki, and Peter and I and Professor Niemelä were making big discussion about something, and Peter said, I need to excuse myself, I'd like to work on my book. And of course, seconds later, there's Peter working on his book. I know Peter's going to say this is apocryphal, but maybe your memory isn't as good as mine anymore. But anyway, this was another piece of serendipity that happened, which was incredibly enriching for me. Here's something else. A student shows up one day, I think it was 1984, he's looking for a PhD advisor. And not only does he want to look for a PhD advisor, he's got his own research program. He already knows what he wants to work on. I thought to myself, how lucky can I be? You know? And it turned out that Dan began his PhD research program and began to work deeply on kind of plant defense theory, and did an incredible job putting together this story about the dilemma of plants. So serendipity, how lucky I was. One day, another doctoral student arrives in my laboratory at Michigan State. He's just finishing his PhD, and he's looking for data that I published in the 1980 annual review article. And I said, well, what are you working on? And he said, I'm working on diet-induced thermogenesis in voles. And I said, really? And he said, do you think anything like that happens in insects? I said, I don't even know what you're talking about. And so anyway, it turned out I hired him, and he and I began these projects on diet-induced thermogenesis, and we published several other papers. More serendipity, and this was Terry's remark to me every day when he left the lab for 2 weeks. More serendipity. A sabbatical professor shows up in Michigan State University, and we go on a road trip to see what's happening in the Great Lakes. And I began telling him about all these dead trees along the highway in lower Michigan. Dead elm from Dutch elm disease. Then we go past the Christmas tree plantation. I said, European pine shoot moth. We go a little further north, the trees are depleted. Gypsy moth. We go a little further north and we see some other invasive. Oh, I said, those white pine over there, introduced pine sawfly. And Peck was going, you have so many introduced European insects here. We don't have any of your American insects. I said, Peck, I don't believe that one bit. So after a couple of days, he said, I'm going to prove this to you. And so then he spent a few weeks, put together a seminar at Michigan State, and that was the beginning of this paper. And the others, we've written other papers too. But I'm getting down to the end here. So turns out that at the station I'm working at, a group of scientists, plant physiologists, forest geneticists, forest ecologists, started this big research project in northern Wisconsin called the Free Air Carbon Dioxide Enrichment System, called the FACE Project. And what it is trees growing in these open chambers with elevated CO2 and elevated ozone. And I thought, what a golden opportunity to look at the effects of CO2 on herbivory. And so for the last 10 years, I've been looking at this question of how elevated CO2, especially elevated CO2, has influenced herbivory in these face rings. And the study is now finished, and it'll be taken down next year, unfortunately. But we've published a couple of papers, and I think I have, what, 6 or 7 that, maybe more, that we're going to publish. But actually, I'm terribly disappointed in what I've learned. There hasn't been anything that's just startling and just exciting. It's all been small, subtle changes that we've seen. And so, but all of the evidence rejects the hypothesis of no effect of CO2 on insects, you know, through the plant. And increased CO2 in the atmosphere, we're 200 parts per million above ambient. So instead of 385, which it is today, it's 585 in the rings. So at 200 ppm above ambient, there's only subtle behavioral and physiological changes. And I can show you all kinds of stuff about that. And so there's just no real large effect. But what I caution is you always have to worry about the butterfly effect in complex systems, where small changes in a complex system can have large unexpected consequences. And so we don't know about that. But my thinking is at the moment that all insect populations will respond more or less uniquely to this enrichment of the atmosphere by elevated CO2, because each of them has its own unique tritrophic niche. And so it has to deal with the plant, all of its predators and parasites. And insect by genotype, by CO2 interactions, are the norm. So it's hard to generalize across species, even within a single species, because of the genetic variation. But this is an example, you know. We've monitored the abundance of wasps, parasitic wasps. There's about 36 species of parasitic wasps, and we've monitored the abundance of flies in these rings to see what's happening. We've done other things too, but this is just a simple example. And that 6 species of parasitic wasps right here, this means they're 3 times more abundant in CO2 rings, foraging for food, than they are in control rings. And if you look at the wasps in ozone, they're usually about 3 times less abundant in ozone rings. What does that mean, Ken? 5? High or bi? So let's get on here. Flies are the same thing. flies are definitely impacted by elevated CO2, and they're much less abundant CO2 rings. But I really think in the near term, much more important than elevated CO2 is the weather changes that are being affected by raised greenhouse gases. And I'll get on with it. And so this is just kind of what I've gutted out from working in the northern forests for the last 10 years. What will global climate change look like with respect to the question of are insects contributing to ecosystem and landscape transitions? If you want to take, if I take you to the northern forests now, where we have had this modified weather pattern for about 10 years, I call it the ragged forest syndrome. And I have six species of plants that I have never seen in my entire career, 42 years, that are in decline. And of course, out west, we've got what's called the pestilence syndrome, which was just wonderfully described by a paper in Bioscience in the spring by Ken Raffa and other colleagues. But let me just show you something. Let's just skip over that. This is what it looks like. When I say the ragged forest, I mean you see trees growing amongst others where their canopies are dying back. And this is dying back probably due to getting their root shoot ratios into balance under these changed moisture regimes. The growing season's longer. They're not getting the moisture that they used to get. And so they're getting root shoot ratios into balance. But what happens in certain cases like this is you've got borers, which are so powerful in taking out these stressed trees. And so we're losing birches. This is so typical. Canary in the coal mine. Oaks, red oaks, doing the same thing. You see this all over. And this two-line chestnut borer comes in, just like it does on the agrilis beetle on paper birch, and takes out these stressed trees. These two critters are very common now. Just every spring, you see these, summer, you see these two insects developing. Larches, large case bearer, an introduced insect, has been very common. And with the drought, this beetle has been taking out larches all over. White spruce declining every place. Jack pine declining and dying everywhere. And what has happened is jack pine under drought starts putting out lots of staminate flowers, male flowers. Well, the budworm need those flowers. It's the bridge to the foliage. If it doesn't have the flowers, it never makes it. So it has been defoliating these trees severely. And of course, these bark beetles, many species are taking out those things. Sugar maples, the same problems. You see crown dieback. I don't know what's killing all the ashes. There's ashes dying all over. It's not the emerald ash borer. They're not there yet. But anyway, let's go out west. Unprecedented bark beetle outbreaks. Largest outbreaks known in the history of North America. And so this is, I think, this whole business of what greenhouse gases are doing to the climate is, it's much more important at this point than what those elevated CO2 changes directly themselves are doing. In conclusion, I want to thank all the inspiring colleagues and former students who have deeply enriched my personal and professional journey. Thanks so much. Keep it up, by the way.
Well, just a couple final words here. First of all, I'd like to thank all the speakers. I think it's been a wonderful symposium, and I think they've made it eminently clear of the impact that Bill has had through his science and mentoring and so forth. And of course, this Bill's impact was recognized in 2005, I think it was, with the ESA Founders Memorial Award, and you can see that it was well deserved. Also, I'd like to thank all of you for coming and sticking this out and listening to the speakers, and to do that, got 150 drink tickets that can be used over here. And I don't know the best way to distribute those. I'll probably just hang out here and I can distribute them as you come up. I'll give some to Ken as well, but again, thank you all very much.
Give me some, I'll pass them on.